What's up, Tony?
Good morning.
I got to start off. So last week we recorded the Israeli-Palestinian conflict episode. People will have heard that probably like a month or two ago now by the time this one actually gets published, because I sort of published out of order in order to get that one out.
It skipped the line, yeah.
Yeah, that one skipped the line. And I just wanted to give a huge, 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 huge heartfelt thank you to everyone who reached out about it, to everyone who left a review about it. I didn't do the podcast to get good reviews. In fact, I fully anticipated a mass exodus from my business and like people just canceling. And I got, bro, I got a lot of death threats. I got a lot of horrific messages, but all of the positive ones really did help mitigate them. And I wanted to give a huge shout out to everyone listening who was kind enough to share, who was kind enough to leave a positive review. It meant the world to me. And also thank you, Tony, for having that conversation with me without you knowing what you were walking into.
No,
so as of right now, in this moment, it's been almost 2 weeks since the October 7 massacre and this whole conflict has begun. So by the time people are listening to this, it could be a whole separate situation globally from what you and I know as of right now. It's October 19th, 2023 right now. So I'm trying to publish every single Sunday. So hopefully we'll catch up with those episodes soon. But I did want to make sure that I give a huge heartfelt thank you to every single person, because some of the reviews have just been so kind, so generous. My favorite ones are just from people who are saying how objective it was and how open-minded it was, and giving the historical context, but also mainly for the people who felt like I did my absolute best to be as objective as possible, which is really what I was trying to do. So thank you for that.
Yeah. I just want to pause on this for a second, just because it's so unreal to me that you are getting death threats right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm getting death threats pretty consistently throughout the day. It's like usually like at least one an hour if I had to put like a pace to it. Yeah.
I'm so sorry that you're even having to look or think about that at all.
Yeah.
Is this the first time this has happened?
No. So every time I go to Israel, I'll always share about it, and I'll always get some upset messages from it. And they range in levels of anger and obscenity. And then every time there's a conflict, I'll usually get death threats or some very high level of anger. But this one is by far the worst that I've personally experienced, like without question. And it's interesting, and this won't be a whole episode about it again, but who knows, maybe it will. Anyone with a little bit of historical knowledge understands how much the printing press really made a huge impact on the world as a whole. I think it was from Martin Luther. I think he invented it. Who invented the printing press?
I think he benefited from it.
Invented German goldsmith Johannes Gutenberg is credited with inventing.
Gutenberg, that's right.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, you're right. It was Martin Luther who benefited from it. Interesting. Okay. So one of the major impacts it had was the ability to spread, obviously, information, but propaganda, like pretty rapidly. And now with social media, it makes the printing press look like a fucking joke, with the amount of propaganda that we are all fed. And I think when people hear the word propaganda, they, at least for, I think a lot of people think of something like World War II, or they think of history. They don't think of modern day. And there's so much propaganda out there right now from every side, from every, whether it's left or right or and center. Yeah, even center, for whether it's religious based or geopolitical based, or there's propaganda everywhere, country to country, all this stuff. So we're all being fed it, and it's easy to get brainwashed by it, which is why it's so important to be objective. But this most recent conflict, has just been absolutely, it's escalated so quickly, so rapidly, with such a huge amount of deaths on both sides. And the propaganda is pushing all of that in people's faces to the point where like their violence is escalating around the world. I mean, there was a 6-year-old Muslim boy who was killed in, I think it was Michigan. He was stabbed over 20 times by someone. I don't know who it was. I don't think they made it public who it was. Maybe they did, but I didn't see it. In which case, like, I don't know if the person was Jewish who did it, but if it was, I hope that person. We could talk about canceling my business. That person deserves to die in a gruesome, horrible way. The person who killed a 6-year-old boy in the United States for something that's happening in the Middle East. So, I mean, there's that from the perspective of like, I'm getting death threats, but then an actual child and his mother were stabbed and he was ended up being killed. So, and then I also think like, I'm not actually in the Middle East. I'm not in Israel. I'm not in Gaza. I have family and friends who are serving on the front lines. So there's a level of guilt that I have about feeling bad about it because I'm not in the line of fire. There aren't rockets coming in there from Gaza towards me. I'm not in Gaza where there's bombs being dropped by Israel. I'm not in the north of Israel where there are rockets being fired by Lebanon and Hezbollah now. There's not a fear, like, who knows what's going to happen over the next coming months, but there's a amount of guilt and shame that I have that I'm not actually there. So it sucks and it's awful and it's made sleeping the last few nights not very fun. I've just been up like watching my Ring cam and like making sure that like no one's coming up to the door. Jeez. And like, you know, and that's why, that's one reason why we try and stay very private and we hide my wife's name, we hide my daughter's name, we don't really share where we actually live. It was actually, we didn't talk about it, but one of the reasons we moved from the building we were in downtown Dallas was because we wanted to move to a house, but there was actually a security threat living very close to us. And so we had to get out of our lease early because there was a little bit of a security threat and that was a little bit of an issue. But yeah, so it's been insane, but I have had it nowhere near as bad as so many innocents. So I feel guilty even bringing that up, but it is, yeah, I've had a lot. So
yeah, it's just probably for a lot of your listeners and you know, I don't think most of us have gotten a single death threat before. So, you know, I just wanted to check in and just
thank you, man.
See how you're doing. We've definitely got a lot of awesome questions from the listeners, not about what's going on in the world, but about the wonderful world of health and fitness.
Are you starting to get more coming in now? People are messaging you with some questions.
Yeah, like some, I don't know what happened. I think we hit a kind of a threshold or something, but now I'm getting a much more steady stream.
Love that.
Of great questions. So super exciting. We're going to try to get as many of them in as possible in these Q&As.
Let's do it.
All right. So this first question is from Kate Rodriguez. And she says, I'm not sure if you'd be willing to talk about this, but I would love to hear his opinions on pricing your coaching. Is there a sweet spot between charging so much that people can't afford it and charging too little so that people don't find value and stick with it because they don't have enough skin in the game to stay motivated?
That's a really good question. So I'll start with this. Number one, what's up, Kate? Thank you for the question. If anyone has any questions they want me to talk about, shoot Tony a DM. We will put his Instagram in the description of the podcast. Need to clear my throat. One second. There we go. I think that should be better. I always find it funny when people say, I don't know if they'll be willing to talk about this. I'm willing to talk about literally anything. There's nothing that's off limits. As long as you're not asking me like, hey, what is your social security number? Mm-hmm. Or like, then I'll talk about it. So, the next thing I'll say is I have an entire podcast about this with my buddy, Mike Vacanti. It's called the How to Become a Personal Trainer podcast, in which we talk about everything from how to design a high-level workout program, to how to understand client behavior and psychology, to business aspects like pricing, social media, all of that. So we'll put the link to that in the show notes as well. But in regard to pricing, number one is, it sounds like the question was largely based on, is there a sweet spot for making people have enough skin in the game to stick with it, but not pricing people out. So it, you're trying to figure out how can you charge enough to keep people consistent, but not charge so much that you're pricing way too many people out of your program. And I will say that generally speaking, if you're coaching people for free completely, you will have a lower success rate, because if you're coaching them for free, they have no skin in the game. They often take the coaching for granted. But realistically, I mean, I remember when I first started charging for coaching, my first prices were like $20 for like 12 weeks. I was a college kid in my dorm room and I was charging people like $20, and they were super consistent with it. And it wasn't much money, whether it was college kids or otherwise, sometimes even some professors that worked in my school, just because I didn't know what to charge. And I was like, I don't know, $20 sounded great. And then I've also charged very, very high amounts of money. And sometimes those people were not consistent at all. And so what I'll start by saying is, if you've never coached before and you're just looking to get your chops and you're looking to become a better coach and no one is really buying from you, start coaching for free. I think it makes a lot of sense. You learn how to be a better coach. You learn systems, you learn assessments, you learn program design, you learn client psychology, and you also get to work with more people. There will be a higher rate of inconsistency, but I do want, if you can get someone to be consistent when they're not paying you, that says a lot about you as a coach. So I would have that as a challenge early on. Then from there, the sweet spot is, I would say, anywhere from $20 a month to $50,000 a month. And that's not an exaggeration. I've worked with people at insanely high price points, not because I said I want this price point, but because they thought that if they paid more, then they would be more consistent. But for someone who's willing to pay a huge amount of money, odds are money is not really an object for them. And so it's like, it's not enough to keep them consistent. You have to find something else that really is going to be that deep driver to keep them consistent. So number one is the level of accountability I've found is far more important than how much money they're spending in terms of how frequently you're interacting with them. I know a lot of coaches do weekly check-ins, and I don't personally have anything wrong with those. I know a lot of coaches do them very successfully, but when I was doing one-on-one coaching, it was a daily check-in. Every day, Monday through Friday, there was just a quick check-in. And if they had questions, they could ask them. But rather than just waiting for once a week, it's like I would do it every single day, which was a little bit harder for me, I think. But from a higher level of consistency, I think it did make sense. So I would say a generally good range for online coaching specifically is anywhere from $200 a month on the low end now, especially considering the economy, would be very low end, all the way up to, I never felt comfortable charging more than $500 a month. Not because you shouldn't do that. I have friends and colleagues who charge double, triple, quadruple that. But for me personally, it just never felt right. Like I felt like at a certain point, it didn't make sense. It didn't feel right for me. So between $200 to $500 a month, I sort of settled around that $300 to $400 a month mark. And that was enough where I was like, that was that sweet spot where I was able to work with a fair amount of people at a cost that a fair amount of people could do. And through the accountability that I had set up within my coaching program, that's what kept them consistent far more than the money. But the only real disadvantage would be if you're charging completely free. That makes that's the most difficult because they just don't value it. Sometimes what I would do is early on is I would say, all right, like you have to pay $100 a month. But if you're 100% consistent or if you're 80% consistent with the program, then I'll give you your money back at the very end. And so that would help them stay super consistent with it. And that's another thing I did early on that really got them excited about it. And let's say like they had an amazing first week, rather than waiting until the end of the month to give them that money back, I'd give it right back at the end of the first week. I'd be like, hey, you crushed it. That's awesome. And just like get them excited, let them know I'm not joking about it. But yeah, that's what I would say about the price and accountability and the sweet spot.
And I do think, at least for myself, there's a turning point where consistency becomes its own reward, where it's like, instead of kind of like, oh, I have to work out, it's like, oh, I'm like, I'm excited to work out. Or if I miss my workout, I'm like, oh man, I really wanted to do that. So from my vantage point, I'm curious what you think those incentives are like to jumpstart someone's motivation or to help them, but it can't be the whole story, right?
It cannot be the whole story at all, because there's different types of people. Some people, like you get to a point in which consistency is its own reward. You love it. You get excited to work out. Bro, there are a lot of people who, no matter what, will just always hate working out. They fucking... Gary Vaynerchuk is like the perfect example. Gary paid me a fair amount of money to follow him for 3 years straight, 7 days a week, all over the world, and coach him every single day because he hates working out. Did I ever tell you the story about my first week with him when I first started coaching him and I didn't fly with him? Did I tell you this?
Oh, no. I don't think this was in the Gary episode.
So we have a whole episode where I talk about working with Gary. We'll put that in the show notes. But I think it was my first 3 days on the job. I was petrified, and this is all covered in the episode, but I was so scared to work with him because I had followed him for years. I had looked up to him. I still couldn't believe I got the job. And part of the job is you travel with Gary. Now, within my first 3 days, I had moved from Israel to New York City to coach Gary. And I assumed that someone would sit me down and explain, all right, this is how you're going to book your flights. This is how you're going to get reimbursed. This is how, like, what you're going to look at Gary's schedule, and we're going to figure out, or maybe they would book my flights for me. That's not how it worked. I was supposed to just look at his schedule, book my own flight, and figure this out on my own. So within my first 3 days, Gary had a trip to Colorado. And I saw that he was in Colorado. So I text him in the morning when like it's his day starts, and I'm in New York City. And I'm like, all right, man, are you ready to work out? He's like, yeah, where are you? And I said, I'm in New York. And he was like, why aren't you here? This is like within 72 dying. Hours of me starting. And I was like, well, I didn't think I got the breakdown yet of how I was going to get there. He's like, you're supposed to book a flight and meet me at the hotel in the calendar. And I was like, oh man, I thought we were going to do FaceTime today because I don't know. And he's like, the reason I'm paying you is for you to be here with me in person, because if you're not here, I'm not going to do it. And I was scared. I thought I was about to get fired on day three. And I was like, okay, no worries. We'll FaceTime right now. And his response, I swear to God, when I said, okay, we'll FaceTime and do the workout, he just goes, ha, 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 ha. That was it. There was no workout. We didn't FaceTime, nothing. And I was so, so worried. And his assistant, Ty, was like, bro, it's okay. No worries. Just like going forward, you book your own flights and then we'll reimburse you. I was like, damn, okay, that sucks. But that's what it was. So going back to that is, some people, no matter how many years they've done it, they will always hate working out. They just won't enjoy it. And so while consistency can be its own reward for some people, the accountability above all else will be the thing that keeps them going and keeps them consistent, because if they don't have to go, then they're not going to go. If there's not someone there or not someone checking in with them, and not everyone can obviously pay for a personal trainer to follow them around the world, but a couple $100 a month to have daily email check-ins to know, like, hey, I'm looking at your program, I'm looking at the weights you're using, I'm looking at your technique, I'm expecting you to be there. That is a huge push for a massive percentage of people.
Yeah. All right. This question is from Missy Paul Beck.
Missy.
And she says, I'm looking to add a question to Jordan Syed's podcast. First, I'm grateful to Jordan and Susan. I listen to their podcast almost daily as I'm on a weight loss journey, 40 pounds so far. My question is, I understand sleep is important, but I don't really understand why or how it is important to weight loss. For example, it is all about calorie deficit, right? How does sleep affect our ability to burn calories?
First of all, Missy, thank you so much for the kind words. Huge congrats on your progress. That's extraordinary. So there are a number of things here to cover. And first I'll say, most of the reason, not all, there are actual physiological reasons why sleep is so important for fat loss, but most of the reason I would say is behavioral. And what I mean by that is, if someone is staying up until 2 or 3 in the morning, usually they're not having celery sticks at 3 a.m. Right? It's usually the, I don't know, ordering buffalo wings or whatever the fuck the people are eating at 3 a.m. It's not a salad. It's not usually not that higher protein, higher fiber option mm-hmm. at 3 a.m. Right? That's number one. Number two, usually people who stay up really late end up waking up later. And then often they'll have less time in the day to get their workout in, to plan their meals. Just from a behavioral perspective, life gets a little bit more difficult if you're staying up late, sleeping in late. Or let's say you stay up late and you wake up early, then you're fucking exhausted. And then you don't want to work out. You don't want to get your steps in. You don't want to plan your meals. You reach for the easier to eat options that are usually higher calorie, less nutrient dense. So behaviorally, you are far less likely to be consistent with the things you want and need to do. Now, there have been times where I was getting very little sleep and I was still very successful with fat loss. I did a mini cut right when my daughter was born to show people that you can still do it. Because like you said, Missy, calories are by far the most important and I have my behavior in check. But most people don't have their behaviors in check and this isn't something that they've developed over years and years and years like I have. So I was able to do it with relative ease. But with that being said, I was hungrier and it was more difficult when those first, 3 months of my daughter being born, especially the first 5 weeks, were absolutely beyond devastatingly hard with the lack of sleep. I was also getting my workouts in at like 10 p.m., 11 p.m., 12 a.m. so that I could do the 1 or 2 a.m. feeding with my daughter. And most people would say, fuck that. I'm not doing that. So I was still finding ways to get it in, but most people aren't doing that. And so I wanted to show people what it was actually like. So the behavior aspect is huge. The other aspect is a lack of sleep radically, and this is more from the physiological side, radically increases hunger. So when you don't get enough sleep, there's no question you're going to be hungrier as a result of it, which is one of the reasons why I think sleep is so important just for hunger regulation, hormone, and we know from a, never mind just fat loss, but hormonal regulation as a whole, sleep is critically important for your overall health. And then on top of it, and this is the most new and up-to-date research, something that a lot of people have, myself included, have been very surprised by. Number one, we know that when you're in a calorie deficit, you're more likely to lose muscle mass because your body is in literally an energy deficit. And in order, maintaining muscle and building muscle is very difficult to do. It's energy costly. So muscle is often first to go. What research has recently found in the last couple of years is that, let's say your calories are the same, your protein is the same, your strength training is the same. The only thing that's changing is your sleep and you're not getting enough sleep. My voice is just pittering out on me right now. What is going on?
Have you hydrated properly this past 24 hours? All right.
Constantly hydrated. But let's say everything is equated for, but you're not getting enough sleep. Your risk of losing muscle mass increases dramatically, even if you're still strength training, even if you're getting enough protein, even if everything else is in check, your risk of losing muscle mass relative to fat mass massively increases. And if you lose muscle mass, well, then you're going to be reducing your metabolism far more quickly than if you were keeping your muscle mass and more or less solely losing fat. So I will say, I think the more important aspects are the behavioral. I think the aspects that have the greatest impact on your long-term success are going to be the behavior of what are you eating at 2 or 3 a.m? How tired are you the next day? How likely are you to get your steps in? Those are the things that I think matter the most. The one that I think is going to get the most interest is the, well, you're more likely to lose muscle mass. And even though it's true, it does have an impact. I don't think it has a dramatic impact. And the reason I say that is this. An extra pound of muscle, one whole pound of muscle, burns about 6 to 8 extra calories a day. 6 to 8.
Yeah.
So if you gain 10 pounds of muscle, then you're burning maybe 60 calories at most.
You could eat an apple, rounding up. Right?
You can have like an apple for 10 pounds of muscle.
I would kill for 10 pounds of muscle right now.
Oh, are you kidding me? Absolutely. Sell my soul for 10 pounds of muscle. So the idea of building muscle, increasing metabolism, what really happens is the main reason why building more muscle can help increase your metabolism. Yes, it actually does because it burns more calories, but people don't realize like a pound of fat also burns calories. It burns like 2 to 4 calories a day. So like the amount of like, it doesn't burn that much more to build muscle. It burns more, but it's not like outrageous, especially if you're not on anabolic steroids and building an extra 50 pounds. So like, and even 50 pounds still isn't like that crazy if you think about it relative to what people assume. But the main reason why having more muscle allows you to burn more calories is because of the lifestyle factors that come with having more muscle. When you have more muscle, what are you doing? You're probably going to the gym more. You're probably getting more steps in. You're being more active in general. It's the lifestyle that comes with having more muscle. It's not that having more muscle necessarily makes you burn tons more calories. It's what you do in order to get and maintain that muscle. Yeah. So walking more, lifting more, being more active as a whole, getting better sleep, all of that. So it's more the behavioral side of it.
Yeah. We all want to draw like a direct causal link between two things. One analogy that came to mind as you were talking about sleep and how it slots in with behavior, a muscle and how it slots in with lifestyle, is it's sort of like you want like the engine, like your body's this machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you just want it to be tuned and running smoothly and like well oiled. And you know, if your sleep schedule's not regular, if you're staying up very late, you know, that's just not optimal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not that every hour of sleep means that you lose this many calories, you know, it's just not that direct.
Exactly.
Nice. All right. This is from Julia Falzone.
What's up, Julia?
And I apologize if I'm mispronouncing everybody's
Falzone.
Name. Falzone. So, hey, Tony, I love listening to you and Jordan on the pod. I think I've listened to every episode. Thank you for all that you guys do.
That's amazing. Thank you so much.
Here's the disclaimer. I have a pretty specific question for Jordan, and I totally understand if it doesn't make it on the pod because it's too specific. I am 24, female, and I've been lifting consistently for about 6 years now and have built a decent amount of muscle. Recently, I've joined a competitive soccer team. The team plays at a decently high level. Many girls in the league played in university, to give you an idea. The conditioning is no joke because playing for 90 minutes and sprinting as hard as possible is a big ask. I'm 5'7 and 160 pounds, and I do not have a typical soccer player body. I'm wondering if it's worth going into a deficit and focusing on cardio rather than lifting so that I am lighter on my feet. Speed is my main asset as a player, and I'm quite a fast sprinter, but I would love to have more stamina between bouts of sprinting. Advice appreciated.
This is an awesome question.
Right?
I love this question. This makes me so happy. It's such a great question because it's a great question for many reasons. One of the reasons I'm excited about it is because it's so athletic performance based, mm-hmm. and it's so different than what I normally talk about. And I think people might be surprised by the answer because in my end of the industry, the strength end of the industry, everyone is always like, just get bigger, just build more muscle. That's always the answer. It's like, well, no, it's not always the answer. And it's okay to not want to get bigger and build more muscle. And in some cases, it's not a good idea. Like in this case, I think Julia is 100% right that now we could talk about the deficit in a second. I think the main focus should just be on conditioning. The main focus should be on conditioning and movement and speed and endurance. I think Julia should be doing a lot of zone 2 cardio on her training days. I would say probably at least 4 days a week of 40 minutes per day of zone 2 cardio. And keep in mind, she's talking about a high level soccer. Like I'm not recommending this for someone who's playing soccer once a week in a rec league and like it's not a big deal. This sounds like it's pretty intensive. So for someone with a higher level athletic performance background who wants to perform at a high level, 4 days a week, 40 minutes of zone 2, I think would be really, 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 really helpful. And generally speaking, the reason I said not to focus on the deficit is because when you start adding this much cardio in, you're going to end up often putting yourself in a deficit, which goes against what so many people say, like you can't outrun your diet. You can't. It's like, well, yeah, of course you can. like it's energy in versus energy out. And if your energy out is greater than your energy in, then for sure. And as long as Julia's not eating like an asshole and eating a fuck ton of food, then she's not going to out, then she can outrun her diet. She's going to be putting herself in a deficit from that energy out. That would not be my recommendation for a sustainable fat loss plan for someone who is just a normal everyday person, because most people aren't going to do 4 days a week, 40 minutes zone two plus their soccer and conditioning on top of it. But the amount that she's going to be training is going to be outrageous compared to the most people. So that makes a lot of sense. I would say strength training, I would keep it to 2 days a week, maybe three. The majority of strength training should be lower body focused. I would say major emphasis on glute hamstring strength, ankle stability, some rotational work, like maintaining your flexibility. But the cool thing is these types of training sessions, they could take 30 to 40 minutes max. And doing some squats, doing some deadlifts, and they don't need to be barbell. In fact, I probably wouldn't really use the barbell at this. I would do more dumbbell focused Bulgarian split squats, lunges, lateral lunges,
yeah, some hip unilateral thrusts,
the unilateral work, step ups, reverse lunges, forward lunges, lateral lunges, single leg hip thrust, cable pull throughs, some goblet squats, Romanian deadlifts. That's it. And then maybe doing some single leg RDLs on an AirX pad for a little bit added ankle stability. But we want to keep your ACLs safe, want to keep your knees safe, want to keep your hips safe. The major issues we see, especially in women playing soccer, ACL injuries, I guarantee Julia and any other women who are listening to this can be like, yep, like I've seen that a lot in female sports. The ACL is very likely to get hurt for a number of reasons, not least of which something called the Q angle with their hip. But also generally women often will not strength train. And so that will put their ACL at a greater risk of injury. So ankle stability, knee stability, hip stability, and the majority then should just be a little bit of speed work, maybe ladder work, and then also zone two. You'll get your sprinting in from soccer.
Yeah.
You don't need to add extra sprints on top of it. That would put more stress in your joints and your central nervous system than you need. But 2 days a week, strength training, 4 days a week, zone two, the rest of your conditioning you get from soccer. And if you wanted to eat in a deficit, you could. I would keep it very minimal. And when I say eat in a deficit, you might be in a deficit just by nature of you doing so much activity. Mm-hmm. But if you want to track your calories, you're welcome to. But my main thing would be, it should be, I would actually eat at what you might consider your maintenance and then use the extra cardio to put you into a deficit, because you're going to need the extra energy in order to perform at your best. You don't want to be eating even into further into a deficit. Mm-hmm. So keep protein around 0.7 grams per pound of your goal body weight. I would probably put it like 0.7 times 150 if she said she's 160, and that would be about 105 grams of protein a day. Fill the rest in with carbs and fats, real emphasis on carbohydrates for that long energy that she's going to need during the soccer games. And as long as you eat around what you consider your maintenance might be, along with all this extra activity, you're going to lose weight, you're going to lose body fat, and you're going to be faster on your feet for sure.
Yeah. Just to drill down a little bit on just the trade-off of like muscle and body weight. I'm mm-hmm. curious what you think, because implicit in the question, I think, is she's wondering if she was 150 pounds instead of 160 pounds, if she mm-hmm. would feel faster, if she would feel like she had more energy. Just at that kind of simplistic level, what do you have to say about that?
Without question. I mean, number one, look at the best soccer players in the world, both men and women. They're very lean. They're very, very lean. Oh, there might be an outlier here and there, but the best soccer players in the world, I mean, like we can even just look at the most iconic soccer players in the world, whether it's, I don't know, Messi or Ronaldo or any of these guys. I don't know that many female soccer players, I apologize. But like even of the ones that I'm imagining in my head, some of the best ones that like Mia Hamm, whatever it is, they're
that's
lean.
The first name that came to my mind too.
Right, like, they're lean. I sort of think of it like a rock climber. It's obviously a very different sport, but you don't see huge, jacked rock climbers. Why is that? It's because all of that extra mass is going to be extra weight they need to carry when they're rock climbing, which makes it way more difficult. Imagine if a rock climber, they're skinny, they're wiry, but they're strong as shit. They're doing one arm chin ups like it's nothing. Their fingers are so strong. If you get if you add 5, 10, 15 pounds of muscle, it's like putting on a weighted vest, which makes it way more difficult. Think about it. If you had to run with a weighted vest on, it makes running way more difficult. You feel it in your knees, you feel it in your back, you feel it in your hips, and you run inherently slower because you are wearing extra weight. That's exactly what's going on when you are carrying an extra 10 pounds of fat, or even with a little bit of muscle, maybe 8 pounds of fat and 2 pounds of muscle. Sometimes it makes sense to reduce muscle mass in order to be more quick, more explosive, and lighter on your feet and have better conditioning. Are you going to get tired faster from having an extra 10-pound vest on versus if you take the vest off and then you play that soccer game? You're going to be way more tired. This is one of the things that is when people watch videos of police officers that I always find very interesting, or anyone in the military, it's not like they're just running like you and I run. They've got a whole kit on. They've got guns. Mm-hmm. They've got ammo. If you've never carried a weapon with several magazines of ammunition, that shit gets heavy very quickly. They've also got bulletproof vests on. That shit gets heavy. They've also got usually a flashlight. They've got handcuffs. They've got so many things on. It's like they're carrying an extra 25, 30, sometimes 50 plus pounds on them, and then they have to run. That's wild. Mm-hmm. It adds a lot. It slows them down. It makes it much more difficult. So yeah, when you take that weight off, you're going to be faster. You're going to be more explosive. You're going to be less likely to get injured. I mean, think about how much extra force you're putting into your knees when you do like a juke style stop. And all of a sudden, like, you have 10 pounds less weight on you. It's, I don't know, 5% less body weight, 8% less of your body weight. It produces way less force. So it's going to be less stressful on your knees. You're going to be less likely to get injured. There's a reason why the best soccer players in the world tend to be very, very lean, like almost erring on the side of what most people would call very, very skinny. And it's not just because of their training regimen, but also because the best players are going to be the ones that are also the most well-conditioned, the fastest, the most explosive, and they need that body type 99% of the time in order to succeed at the highest levels. That's one of the cool things we hear about the term model athlete. This is one of my favorite things to think about, a model athlete. And you think about what that might look like. Generally speaking, when you look at the highest levels of sports, Olympic caliber, they almost all look the same, especially when you're doing a team sport and you can look by position. Like, most midfielders have a very similar build. Most quarterbacks have a very similar build. Most running backs have a similar build. And there are outliers, but most of the people at the same position, at the same high caliber sport, at the highest levels, look not skin color necessarily or facial features, but their body type, their height, their weight, they look very similar. That's not an accident.
Yeah, you could spot a marathon runner in a group of cyclists.
Correct,
you know?
Exactly.
You could tell the difference.
You can see like sprinters. You ever see like female sprinters or male sprinters? But like, bro, their glutes are freaking nuts.
Yeah.
There's a reason why sprinters are so jacked, and especially their glutes. The glutes are the most and their glutes and hamstrings, and they're just fucking jacked. But a marathon runner isn't going to look like that. Well, all that extra weight, all that extra mass on a marathon runner is going to hinder them. It's very different, but it's very cool when you look at a model athlete at the highest level in a certain position. The best soccer players in the world are not jacked. They're not. Oftentimes they take their shirt off and either they're really, really skinny, so skinny that like you can see their abs, or they're what many people here in the US would like consider soft, like skinny fat. Like, oh, there they have a little bit of extra, like they're not fat, but like they're not jacked. They don't have tons of muscle. So yeah, because they need to be fast. That's by design.
Yeah. She did mention that sprinting is one of her strengths
because she's strong. She's got muscle.
Yep.
She's already got that muscle. She's developed that. What people don't realize very often is that strength training and sprinting is the exact same energy system. The energy system that you use to lift deadlift for 5 reps is the exact same energy system you use to sprint. It's the same exact, you're creating as much force as you possibly can for a brief period of time. A sprint, by definition, is a very short period of time. A deadlift is a type of sprint. It is your sprint. You're going as hard as you can for a very brief period of time. That's it. You use the exact same energy system. Whereas zone two cardio is a very different energy system, but that's what's going to give her the ability to go for an entire game without having to get subbed out.
Yeah, I played soccer growing up and in high school, and yeah, you run a lot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And imagine if her strength or anyone's strength is their ability to sprint, but they get tired after 5 sprints or 7 sprints or 10 sprints. Well, now their sprint is no longer their strength because their first sprint, second sprint, third sprint was really, really good. But now by the time the 10th sprint comes, 12th sprint comes, 15th sprint comes, now their sprint is they're slower than the person who used to be slower than them. So what if we reduce her max sprinting ability by a small percentage, but increase her ability to sprint for the entire game? So by the time the game ends in the last half, she's able to sprint faster than she was before, like in the last mm-hmm. half prior. Well, now she's actually sprinting faster, even though her max sprint is slower yeah. because her conditioning is better.
Yeah. Just curious, have you ever seen any relationship between zone two and sprinting?
There is a relationship. It's interesting. So the way that I would describe it is zone two is like your engine. Okay. It's like and we'll talk about the different capacities. So you have your aerobic capacity. And I hate explaining it this way just because it makes people think it's two completely different systems, and they sort of are, but they're more interchangeable. It's a spectrum and they run into each other. Your zone two is training your aerobic system, and your aerobic system is your engine.
Mm-hmm.
I am not a car guy, but I'm about to try and do a car analogy, so it might not make any sense.
I tried that too, and I was like, is this, do I know what I'm talking about?
If you have a bigger engine, I don't know if this is true in real life, but imagine you have a bigger engine. The bigger engine, the faster you can go and the longer you can go, right? The bigger your engine, the more fuel you have. And we're just going to use this for the analogy, right? Imagine that a bigger engine means you have more fuel and you can go for longer and you can go faster. Well, this is your aerobic capacity. After you get out of your aerobic capacity, then we're going to, I can't believe I'm going car analogy. I know nothing about cars. I know nothing. After the engine, we've got your nitric oxide boosters or whatever it is, like your NAS. I only know that from Fast and the Furious. They got your NAS boosters. That's your sprint. But if your engine is very small, then you're going to have to use your NAS earlier. You're going to rely on your NAS sooner than you would have if your engine was bigger. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I don't know, because you're smirking, so I can't tell.
It's just a funny analogy, and I'm thinking of Fast and Furious now.
Right?
And
like, imagine if your engine was way bigger, then you're able to just continue using from your engine before you actually need to rely on the NAS. And so the reason this can help sprinting, especially longer duration for over many, many sprints over the course of a game, is because if you're only relying on that big, big engine, you can recover more quickly. I don't know how NAS works, but I don't think you have an unlimited supply.
Right.
With your engine, you have unlimited supply. With NAS, for the sake of the example, you don't. And that's what sprinting is. You don't have an unlimited supply of sprints. Zone two, you can do for hours and hours and hours. And zone two builds up your engine so that you can keep going and maintain a higher output without getting as tired. That's one of the main benefits of zone two. It increases your work capacity. Whereas with NAS, like, no matter what, sprinting is going to make you tired. As soon as you tap into NAS, I don't care how conditioned you are. I don't care like how amazing you are, how athletic you are, how conditioned you are, how good of a sprinter you are. Once you tap into NAS, the time has begun. You've turned that sand thing over and the sand mm-hmm. is starting to pour out. So you want it. The people who have a bigger engine and can wait longer to tap into NAS will be able to sprint for longer, be able to sprint faster, because it takes them longer to get to a higher intensity before they're actually tapping into that NAS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Definitely. Is that so aerobic and then anaerobic?
Yes. Yeah. And there are different aspects within it, but yeah, generally mm-hmm. you got your aerobic and anaerobic. Correct. And sprinting is anaerobic, as is deadlifting. Is anaerobic. It's the same energy system.
Yeah. You know, in jiu-jitsu, one of the things they talk about a lot is just being calm and not overexerting yourself. Like, mm-hmm. even if you're in a bad position, don't just like struggle and waste all your energy.
Yeah.
And you do see it in like fights, in boxing or UFC or something. Mm-hmm. Earlier matches, people look a lot different than in later matches, because I think they've used up some of that sprint.
And yes,
it doesn't come back as fast, right?
Yeah. And there's telltale signs. You can look for it. You know, someone, when they first start the fight, they're breathing through their nose, their mouth mm-hmm. is closed, they're bouncing on their feet.
Mm-hmm.
Then the third round comes, their mouth is hanging open, they're no longer bouncing, they're not moving their head. All of a sudden, they're slower, they become an easier target. And it, there are telltale signs of when people are getting more and more tired. So it was funny. I was at jiu-jitsu last night, and I've turned a corner in my jiu-jitsu where I still get smashed all the time. I still get smashed like all the time. But now I've turned a corner where I would say a lot of the time I'm able to do the smashing, even though I'm 5'4" and 142 pounds, like, because I've been doing it for so many years and it's so skillful and technical, I can do a lot of the smashing if I want. And I was working with this young kid yesterday, and really sweet young kid. And I remember when I first started, I used to get so exhausted so fast because I was like, I would try and get out, explode. I'd try to use my strength. And that's what he was trying to do against me. He was trying to use his strength. He was trying. And like the phrase in jiu-jitsu is you just let him cook.
Mm.
You just sort of sit there and let him cook. And at most, someone who's super well conditioned has a minute. Someone who's super well conditioned, has a lot of energy, is going to be able to go crazy for a minute. And after a minute, they will be so tired that they won't be able to move. And often they'll just tap out. They'll quit just because they're exhausted and their heart rate's going so crazy. I mean, imagine doing a max effort deadlift for a minute straight. It's like usually after five reps of a deadlift, your heart rate's through the roof. And that took, what, 17 seconds at most? So in jiu-jitsu, you just let them cook. Same thing with any fight, but in jiu-jitsu especially, you can just let them cook, try and go crazy for a minute. And then after that, you can do literally anything you want to them because they're so exhausted. They're so drained. So the being able to stay relaxed, this is why if you watch sprinters, if anyone wants to see something very cool right now, go on YouTube and look at sprinters as they're doing, I don't know, 100 meter dash, whatever it is. Their faces are like, blah, 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 blah. Like you can see their faces just like are loose, and the skin on their face is blah, 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 blah. It's because they need to figure out ways to relax all of the muscles that aren't necessary for this. And if they are over tensing, number one, it can slow them down, but also it's going to waste energy. So they want to relax, lose tension in the muscles that don't need to be used, and apply a maximum force in the muscles that are being used. And so when most people sprint who are not good sprinters, they're like scrunching their face. They're like,
face of exertion.
For the best sprinters, they're not, their faces are completely blah, 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 and they're sprinting so hard and so fast, you can actually, it sees like it looks like a dog out the window. Exactly. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It's very cool.
I remember I was going to a Strong First trainer. They're the kettlebell organization.
Pavel.
And I remember the trainer, she'd be like, stop making that face. I'd be doing goblet squats or something. She's like, don't do that. And it was the same reason. She was basically like, yeah, you don't want to use any of that energy. Like, you want to be calm. You want it to all be in the muscles that you're using.
That's exactly right. There's also the mental component of if you're scrunching your face and you're like really like tensing, then it's almost like it's easier for you to then convince yourself mentally and emotionally that it's harder than it is. And oftentimes you'll end up from a rate of perceived exertion perspective, you'll rate it higher. Like you'll be like, oh my God, that was like a 10 out of 10. But if you just relaxed your face and were calm, you might have rated only a 7 and you could have gotten another 5 or 6 reps out. But because you were scrunching, you were making it really difficult, like you thought that it was way worse than it actually was.
Yeah. What was the powerlifting protocol that they did in, I don't know if it was Bulgaria or somewhere in Eastern Europe, where the whole idea was like they didn't really like warm up a lot, but they would just basically do heaviest reps possible as routinely as possible, like it was nothing. And like that was to train their nervous system to not like be afraid of the heavy weight. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm trying to remember the name. It's not the Bulgarian method, is it?
I wanted to say that, but then you said Bulgarian split squats earlier. And so
that might have been it actually. Because the Bulgarians notoriously, among their lifters would have some of the strongest lifters in the world, but they would also have lifters who had like the shortest lifespan in sport. Not that they would die early, but like they
injury,
they the injury and burnout because they it was too much on them. So yeah, I think you're talking about the Bulgarian method.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, it's just it's so interesting, like the intersection between how you think about something and how it manifests physically. Oh. We could do a whole episode on that, but
100%.
I don't know the science. I just think it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's very real. It's very real. I mean, our brains are unbelievably powerful, and it's actually nuts. And that's, you know, when you're in a life or death situation, whatever it is, why they're always so forceful about saying you need to remain calm, you need to relax, doing whatever you can do to often talk to yourself, walk yourself through that situation. Because if you're in your brain and you're panicking, it can get way, 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 way worse. Or even if you're telling yourself something is going to be painful, people can think that it's going to be painful. And then researchers will touch them with a stick thinking that it's going to be really, really hot. And it's actually not hot at all. It's like room temperature, but people rate it like it burned me on this level.
Wow.
It's crazy. It's nuts. Your brain can just be your greatest asset or your worst enemy, depending on how you use it.
That must be why the doctor is always like, oh, it's just going to be a little pinprick.
Yeah. 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 That is 100% why. A little pinch. Yep. And whenever they say it, I was like, I wish they wouldn't say pinch, because it's just, no one likes to get pinched. Just like, I think what they should say is like, you're going to feel a little pressure. Pressure is a better word to use than pinch, I think. No one likes to get pinched. And a pinch always hurts. But a little pressure would probably be a better thing to say if you're going to get a shot or something.
Doctors, take note.
Yeah. But dude, I got to get going because my wife and I have a meeting. We are, we're meeting with the builder, the potential builder for the house. We're meeting with the potential builder. I know I said I'd give updates on what's going on and all that. I think I initially a couple episodes said like we cut the budget by half, by literally 50%. So meeting with him, and we cut the budget by half, but then we sent him the architect design, and the guy was like, this isn't going to fit in your budget. And I was like, okay, well then let's meet and let's just nip tuck this motherfucker until we can cut everything out that is completely unnecessary and make it fit the budget. So that's what we're going to go do right now.
Good for you.
Yeah, man. I'm not going over budget right now. No, no way. No way. But I appreciate you, brother. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, and thank you to everyone listening. Wow. This is like, literally, it's one of those conversations where I was like, I forgot we're recording. Thank you to everyone listening. I literally completely forgot. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. If you did, please leave a 5-star review on iTunes. They help so much. They really do. It means the world to me. If you want to follow Tony, please follow Tony. He's amazing. He's just completely elevated the podcast and the conversation to a whole new level. His Instagram is in the description. If you want us to answer any questions, shoot them to his Instagram. Make sure you give him a follow. Have a wonderful week. I'll talk to you soon.